If you want to know what Australians are doing, listen to Macca on Sunday.
Especially the podcast, and it'll make you feel good. And is there anything more needed in this crazy world than a bit of feel good? This morning, as usual, conversations with Australia. Try young Frank and Lottie and Shusu Gasaki. Apples and seafarers and, oh, look, just enjoy. Where are you, Louise?
Oh, good morning, Macca. I'm in the Amamore State Forest.
Well, tell everybody.
Well, it's absolutely beautiful. I'm here for the Gympie Muster.
Which starts?
At the end of the month. I've been here for 2 weeks already.
You're keen. You're getting good seats, eh? Is that the story?
Oh, good camping area, Macca. Really good camping area.
Uh-huh.
I'm camped on Ferrell Hill. And
where else would you want to camp? Yeah, go
on. Of course. Now, oh, it's absolutely beautiful out here. But what's been amazing? The bell birds have come back.
Mm.
For a long time, the bell birds had gone, and now they're back again this year. It's absolutely beautiful waking up of the morning and hearing them.
Yeah, they're a bit of a, I don't know, somebody doesn't like, there's people who don't like bellbirds. They sound lovely, the chiming. When we were kids, we'd drive through the mountains and you'd hear them, beautiful things. But so you're just a country music fan, Louise, is that the deal?
I am, yes, I do. I love country music.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. All right, well, end of the month it starts.
That's right.
All right, well, enjoy yourself, okay?
I will, thank you.
All right, I bet it's beautiful there this morning. Cool.
Well, it's amazing. Normally it's -8 degrees up here, but this morning it's 14, so it's great.
Oh, that's good. Good on you, Louise.
Thank you, Macca.
See ya. Bye.
Bye.
Good day, this is Macca.
Oh, good morning, Macca. It's Kelvin Alley speaking. I'm calling you from Lightning Ridge. I'm on a push bike and I'm about to leave and head across the Queensland border this morning, but I'm on a 5-week 3,500-kilometre solo bike ride for charity, and I've just enjoyed a day's rest at Lightning Ridge.
you're a, what's the word? Doesn't matter. you're a Revo, Kelvin, aren't you?
Yeah.
So when did you start this?
I started 2 weeks ago. I left a little seaside place called Diamond Beach near Taree, and I took a week to ride through the Hunter Valley and on the way to Canberra. Had a tiny reception when I arrived at Parliament House, and then I left from the War Memorial. I left from the War Memorial.
What's a tiny reception, mate?
About five people, but I had Angus Taylor's media staff. They were there too, because I'm going to start riding with him in a week's time when I meet him at Toowoomba. We're riding for veterans, wandering warriors. So they just thought it was not.
What's happened to you? What happened to your phone then? Your phone's just disappeared. Now it's come back.
Yeah, I've been noticing that listening to you this morning. I lose a few seconds every now and again. I don't know whether it's just being here at Lightning Ridge.
BAI, I'd say, or we could ring Elon Musk. He'd know about it. Are you on Skylink?
Yeah, I wouldn't have a clue. I'm on a Telstra dongle. In my little motel room. But, Macca, I've had a great time. And, you know, we live in a great country. I've just enjoyed country town after country town. Since leaving Canberra, I've headed north up through Bynalong and Young and Canoundra. And I got caught in a terrible blizzard day Monday. I had to abort, I confess. It was just too frigidly cold and dangerous. And
where was that?
I stopped at Kewdale. I'd made it from Canoundra to Kewdale, but I was just a frozen block of ice. It was snowing at Orange, and it was just blowing a blizzard and raining like anything.
Wow.
I was wet to the it was awful. But, you know, anyway, so I for my own sake and for because the wind blows you all over the road. So I carry all my gear on the bike, you know, because it's like a small truck.
So you're not travelling light?
No, well, I've got about 20-odd kilo. So if you buy a big bag of soil from Bunnings, try and lift that. That's 20 kilo.
Mm.
And put it on the back of the bike and, you know, ride up all those hills I've been on. But, look, it's so good. It's just a great adventure.
And you're riding for what?
Wandering Warriors. They support veterans who have served in our special forces, mainly with education programs to help them back into the workforce once they've done their service for our country. I'm up to about $10,000, but if there's, you know, folk who'd like to support, I've got a link on my Facebook page, Kelvin Alley. And I understand you know my cousin, David Alley.
Dave and I go back, Dave ran around Australia and then paddled down the Murray and then walked to the moon. He's a legend. And there's some problem in his brain, and you've it's hereditary, obviously.
I think he said to me the other day, it must be in the genes, but perhaps it is a brain, perhaps it is a brain problem. But Macca, it's just great. Lightning Ridge is just a phenomenal.
That's where you are this morning, right?
Yeah, it's 9 degrees. It's not that cold now. I've passed through all the worst of it. And I'm heading today. I'm excited because I live at the Gold Coast and I'm heading back over the Queensland border. And I'll get to St George and then I'll turn east. I think I've lost you again now.
I'm here.
You're there.
If you're there, I'm here.
I'm here. Yeah, I get to St George and then I'm going to turn east for the final time and head towards Toowoomba, then home. And I'll be home in 3 weeks. 3 weeks today. So it's been a great adventure, and it's been good to meet. People are so kind to me, you know. In some places where I've stayed, they won't charge me anything, and they feed.
Well, they probably pity you, Kelvin. That's why they're kind. You know, every look at this poor bee. We better give him a cup of tea or something like that.
It's all for a good cause, though, and I've met some good veterans too. You know. A fellow I've never met, but he served our country in Vietnam. He's here in Lightning Ridge, and they took me to dinner last night. And they're such lovely Australian people. And
it's nice to be in a country town. I mean, there's something different about it. I mean, where do you live, in the city or in a country town?
I live in a suburb at the Gold Coast. Near Tembrin.
That's the city, and you notice the difference when you get to a country town.
Absolutely.
It's still like it was, 30 years ago in the city. There's so many people in cities now, and they're not conducive places. I mean, I you could write an essay about what's happened to Sydney, and I assume what's happened to Melbourne, where, you know, people routinely are fighting with machetes and things like that in Melbourne. And so you go to a country town, and that's not going to happen in Lightning Ridge. Or it doesn't matter where you are. You know, it can be on. It's just a different, and it's reassuring to go to you found out.
It is. It's a different world, and I felt totally safe in every place I've been in. Walgett and Gilgandra, you know, all these places, I have felt totally safe. And you're right. There's a certain culture about the country that's such a good thing, and so much history too, Macca. I just can't believe the history that's contained in our little towns. I just wish more people would travel Australia rather than travel the world. You know, there's so much to discover.
Kelvin, when you get back home, you can align yourself for some counselling, and maybe this won't happen again.
all right. Well, my counsellor, his name is David Alley, and
I'm going to have coffee with him.
I'm going to have coffee with him at Pottsville when I get back, and we're going to trade war stories about our challenges on the bikes.
Jump on my
Facebook page, Kelvin Alley. It's open to the public, and there's a link, and I'd love to get lifted up to, I don't know, 15 or 20. So I could say I've done a good job for the veterans.
Good on you, Kelvin.
Thank you, Macca. Bless you today.
Bye. Bye, mate. G'day, this is Macca.
Yes, good morning, Macca. Jason speaking.
Hi, Jase.
Yeah, I'm tug engineer and heading into Port Botany to do a job this morning. I believe you know a colleague of mine in the same industry, Michael Kelly.
I do, and I know some. I met some of the tug people, engineers and pilots too, one time or another there on the port. But they're all around Australia and Port Melbourne. I've been on a tug and then down in Hobart not in Esperance, but I went out in a boat in Esperance. But anyway, what's happening, Jase?
We've got a ship coming in. There's one coming in, I think, at the moment, and there's another one at 0845.
You're busy? Yeah. I suppose you're always busy, aren't you? I mean,
we're always busy. It never sleeps.
No, we rely. We live in Australia. And I don't know if a lot of people think about it, but we rely on all the things that come in. And you only have to see one of those boats come in, or two of them, or three of them. They're huge. What, they're 300 metres long or something ridiculous?
Yes, you're right. over 300 metres long, and some of those will take about four tugs to put it in, and about 110,000 tonne dead weight.
Isn't it amazing? And imagine trying to sift through all those. How many containers would they hold, you reckon, one of those boats?
I think those ones are around, they're only relatively small compared to the ones overseas. I think, don't quote me, but we're looking around about 10,000 TEU, which is 20-foot equivalent units. So that's, each box is 20-foot, but the bigger ones, they're 40-foot containers.
Oh, dear, oh, dear. Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? Amazing. Jason, how did you get into piloting a ship?
Oh, I'm not a pilot. I'm an engineer.
You're the engineer, you're right. Okay.
And I'm an engineer, which is an honourable trade. I started out my time 40 years ago at Garden Island Dockyard as a fitter and turner apprentice.
Uh-huh. Go on.
And then progressed. I went to Sydney TAFE and did the studies there, and then finally got away to sea with a shipping company called Howard Smith Industries, which is no longer with us. Yes, they were going to go into a little hardware business called BBC, and that proved to be the end of Howard Smith Shipping, where they'd been in the industry for over 100 years.
Yeah, we used to have quite a number of Australian maritime companies, didn't we? But no longer, which is quite strange. But there's always talk about restarting it up. You know, there's been, because people have realised how ridiculous it is for a country girt by sea not to have any maritime fleet or even companies that deal with that. All our ships' captains and things like that, well, they don't exist really. They're all from overseas, and that's fine. But you'd think that a country that is girt by sea would have some. Yeah, have their own little unit of boats and things.
Absolutely, Macca. Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head there. It is a travesty. Yes, there were, I forget how many ships there were when I first started, certainly over the 100 mark, and now we're down to a handful, really. So,
yeah, well... Anyway. You only have to look around the world and see what sort of state the world's in when you need to be. And it was always the same. We need to be self-reliant in whatever we do, whether we're, you know, playing football or looking after the country. You need to be self-reliant in the things you do. And it just makes sense, Jason, but you have to take people kicking and screaming into the present day, you know, into reality. But happen. It may happen, Jason.
Well, one can hope. One can only hope. You'll have to come for a ride with us someday, Macca.
I'd love to, as long as we don't go outside. I don't think I'm a seafarer, mate. But when you get on your boat and you just head off, you must feel like you're going on holidays. You're leaving the mortal coil, and you're out in the sea. And it must be a wonderful feeling, I think, to do that, even if you're just going out. And those boats are so big. And then sometimes you'll get those huge seas that come in through the heads wherever you are, you know. And all of a sudden you're rocking around. And hey, it's
another. I'll give you the extremes. The tug on one of them today will be, she's a 28 metres. By 10 metres beam, so 28 metres long. And then there was one time I was bringing a tug down from Brisbane, and that tug was 30 metres by, I think, 11, from memory, reaching back. And we came out of Caloundra, we're heading down, and we came into a 10-metre swell on a 30-metre tug.
Wow, dear, oh, dear. And are you a good seafarer? I mean, do you get crook or...?
On the bigger stuff, I'm okay, but I find I'm being challenged occasionally in certain conditions. Yeah. Now, from the smaller stuff, but anyway, we get through it. It's it is a lifestyle. It's not for everybody, but it's certainly, I found it rewarding over my years.
Oh, when I went out on a tug once and they pulled up beside one of these huge ships we're talking about, it's unbelievable, isn't it? And then there's all these seafarers on board. They're from all over the world, you know. They're from the Philippines and whatever. And they see and they're wearing their little beanies and they're visiting a different port in the world all the time, and they're carrying containers or out of Esperance it'd be ore or wheat or barley or all sorts of things, or down in Wollongong it's cars, and it's just really exciting stuff, isn't it?
What goes on those ships in the container trade or tankers? There was a tanker I was on many years ago called the Stolt Australia, and it was one of the hardest working ships. As we say, it never went anywhere in ballast, which means there was always a cargo on board, and we used to carry the fun runs was we'd take diesel from Melbourne across to King Island, fuel for the people there on the island. And then so we'd manage to get up the road and we'd buy some cheese up there at the dairy and also we go to the butcher shop and we get some King Island beef. That was a little treat up the road. Then we'd do another run where we'd load fuel oil for a power station in a place in New Caledonia called Ngāpuhi.
Wow.
And we'd go up there. We'd be there for about a week discharging the fuel, and then we'd go across. We'd have to clean the tanks, the cargo tanks, and then we'd head over to Mackay, and we'd load molasses in Mackay and bring that back down to Melbourne. So the tanks going from fuel oil to molasses, so which is sugar, and they had to be spotlessly clean. And we used to test for that. The mate would test for that. Yes, it passed the test, and so it was all right to load the cargo.
Yeah, there was a ship that used to come out of Newcastle called the Wallara or Wallara Wallara.
I
spoke to the blokes who ran that, and this is, I don't know, 10 years ago before it closed down, and we were always going to go for a run on it down to Catherine Hill Bay and go for a run on that, which would have been great. But when you think about the coastline, and sometimes we get a call here from the barges right across, who go right across the top, you know, and refuel places and take goods into, you know, around the top through in Darwin and all around there. It's an amazing coastline. And then look at New Guinea and all around the things that go on up there. I mean, a life on the ocean waves, mate, is never boring. It's lots of things, but it ain't boring because you never know what's around the corner. Beautiful days and then paybacks and,
So I was on a ship, Howard Smith. We used to run from Sydney to Ubay in Japan. It was a two-week run up and two-week back. That was taking coal from Ball's Head there in Sydney, where the old loader there at North Sydney. Occasionally we'd take coal from Newcastle to Ubay in Japan. And that, as you said, the coastline, it's spectacular. You're heading up and then you'd turn out and you'd go up through New Guinea and you'd go through an area called Jomar Passage. And then you'd head off to, and you're just passing all these islands and you think you're on some sort of exotic cruise. the reality soon sets in. You weren't.
Yeah, but you're not with. You know, you're not on a cruise because you've got not another 3,500 people with you.
No,
joining
true.
For tea
that's
and true. Stuff like that. Yeah.
Jace, yeah.
I'll see you sometime on the. I'd love to go for another join on the tug and pull up. It's awe-inspiring when you pull up beside one of those huge tankers and you know you. And you're the difference. I tell you, I replayed an interview I did with Peter Domigan, who was a pilot up at Port Alma, one of the places he'd worked at, which is, I don't know if you know about Port Alma, which is Rockhampton's port. And he was telling me about, because there's no tugs there, they've got to go in with anchors and reverse and, you know, and it was a mighty story. And he said, I told the captain, this might be a ship's captain from the Ukraine or from the Philippines or whatever, and he said, now, Captain, there's no tugs here, so we're going in. And then as they get close, he said, the captain said, now, what about the tugs? He said, Captain, I told you, there's no tugs here. We'll have to use the anchors. And he said, oh, well, and then the captain starts to panic because he said, oh, one of the anchors may not work. And he said, and the reversing engine may not work. And he said, but we've had no, well, they go in, you know, on the skin of their pants, but, you know, they never had a problem. But it's always exciting at sea, Jace.
Yeah, there was another, another good friend of mine, Sister Mary.
Oh, yeah. We met Sister Mary a couple of months ago, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And a quick shout-out to some friends of mine. He may be listening. A bloke by the name of Ant Myers down there at Threadbow. He manages a ski club down there called Pindari Ski Club. He's from Grenfell. So I'm pretty sure Ant had the radio on there. He'd be cooking breakfast for the guests.
Oh, that'd be nice. I think they're expecting some snow a little later this week, which it hasn't been a big snow year because of a drought. It's a drought year, I think. Not a lot of rain around so down there. Not much snow. Good on you, Jace. Great to talk to you. I'll see you.
Have a wonderful day.
See ya. Bye.
Bye.
G'day, this is Macca.
Oh, g'day, Macca. It's Greg.
G'day, Greg.
I'm your train driver. Last time I called you, I was on a Brisbane to Melbourne train coming through Benalla in the early hours of a Sunday morning.
Well, I sort of remember that because I remember a train call. You know, I remember when people are doing things like that or Jason on the tug. Yeah, when was that, Greg? That was a while ago.
Oh, that was probably late last year, yeah. I thought I had an interesting job, but it's not as exciting as the ocean captains, is it?
Well, you know, you're on the tracks, but their tracks can suddenly be 10 metres as well. So that'd be exciting too, I suppose. But you've got the postcard in front of you. You just go on the tracks and you look at the world, and as you're trundling through country towns on a quiet Sunday night or whatever, it's all wonderful, Greg.
It's a beautiful morning this morning, a beautiful sunrise. I live in Castlemaine, so I'm driving on my way to Footscray, and we had thick fog through Kyneton, Karlsruhe and Woodend, 0 degrees. I'm on the call to highway. I'm currently at Sunbury at 6 degrees, so Melbourne's a bit warmer than Castlemaine.
So you're not on board your train this morning?
No, we're a bit short-staffed, so I'm doing an extra job. I'm just going into a local job this morning. I'll be putting the fuel and oil and cleaning the cabs, marshalling them up, fixing minor repairs, taking them down to Spotswood if they need service. So someone's got to do all the background work to make the trains run.
I suppose, and yeah, shortage of, because there's been a bit of sickness around this winter too, as I know very well, but there's quite a lot of people who are, you know, friends of mine, I ring people or they ring me to see what I'm doing or what's happening, and they're crook too, you know, so I don't know if that's that'd affect every big company that needs lots of people and the transport industries, trains and buses and things like that. They must be, put upon when in winter, especially winter. I don't know. I think it's the chill. I think, you know what, I think it's the cold that starts everything off. And I don't know. And lots of people get crook and it affects everybody's industry.
What happens with us, we train them up and they tend to go west where the big money is to drive the ore trains over there, the Gina or BHP.
Yeah.
Or they go to V-line where it pays a bit better and there's no night shifts. So we have this constant revolving wheel of training people and saying goodbye to them.
Well, and that's life, isn't it, too? You know, I remember hairdressers would do that and they'd get somebody on for an apprentice for a year and then they go and then they shoot through. And so I suppose it was ever thus, but I don't know, Greg, what you do about it. It makes life hard. It's not just doing your job. It's making sure that you get people to do the job because that's the whole problem. And it's the same here at the ABC, I suspect.
Yeah, so I'm doing extra today. I'm doing extra on Tuesday. I'll go to Junee on a Melbourne-Sydney train.
Mm.
Come back Wednesday. On Thursday, I'll do a Melbourne-Adelaide train to Dimboola and bring a Perth to Melbourne train back Friday. So I'm a part-timer who works 2 days a week, so I'll be 5 this week.
Do you obviously like the trains?
Yeah, I'm going to retire again. I retired in 22. I came back in 24 as a part-time. So grand final days, me that's when I finish. Yeah, I'm going to retire again.
You're not tempted to go to the West?
Too late, too old now, yeah.
Why are you too old? Have you got to be young? You've got to be a certain age, have you, to do that?
Oh, I'll be 68 later this year, so that's enough.
Yeah, I suppose so. But, again, that would be an interesting exercise, wouldn't it? The wide open spaces there. And there's all sorts of little, because we had a call the other day from, but he was driving a truck with ore trains. There's the big mines over there, but there's lots of little smaller mines over there too, which you could do things. And some of them got small, you know, trains. So I don't know. Be interesting for a while, Greg, but you're right. You know, you can't pull up roots late in life, I don't think.
I did put in for that job once in about 2005, and they had 400. They had 400 applicants for the same job.
Really?
So everyone's got the same thing. Yeah, it's big money. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you got to do what you like to do too. If you find a job that you like, and you sound like you like your job, you're in front, I reckon. Money's not everything, you get to the end of your life. And I mean, people say, they used to say about 20 years ago, they say, oh, you need $1 million to retire on. But when you get to 70 and 80, you'll find that you're not spending a lot of money at all, you know. You don't need all that money.
I'm still married. I've got a wife who spends it.
Oh, I see.
She'll be listening too.
Good on you, Greg. Great to talk to you, mate.
Good on you. Just a shout out to my neighbour, Des. He'll be listening as well.
Desi, all right. Okay, great to talk to you, mate. I'll come for a ride in a train one time. I love doing that.
Yeah, that'd be great.
All right, mate. See you soon. G'day, this is Macca.
Oh, g'day, Macca. It's Ned Makem here.
How are you, Ned?
I'm very well. I'm just on the road between Ningen and Inverell, but just out of Nevertire.
All right.
Absolutely beautiful morning here.
That's the motto of Nevertire, isn't it? We never tire in Nevertire.
But I went down to Ningen
Through the keeper, didn't it? You didn't.
Yeah. Well, I was being as courteous as I could, you know.
Anyway, sorry, Ned. Go.
No, you're right. I've been down to the Ningen Big Boar Bonanza, which is probably the biggest wild pig catching competition in Australia. And I just wanted to report in that the estimates at this stage are still doing the figures are that they've accounted for more than 5,000 pigs in about 60 hours.
When did that take place, Ned?
It finished up last night. They started on Thursday at midnight, and went right through. They had 183 teams, and those teams averaged about 30 pigs each. They don't bring all of those in; they just bring in the ones they think might win a prize. Part of my role, I'm a volunteer, and with the Australian Pig Doggers and Hunters Association, we go down and verify numbers and things like that, because we're feeding those numbers back to the government to try and give them a couple of ideas on how many pigs there are in the bush and how much volunteers are contributing to trying to get them under control.
Well, we've just been talking about the census, haven't we? A pig census. Did somebody say the other day, did I read somewhere, 5 million pigs?
Look, that's a wild underestimation.
Yeah, that's what I would think too. When I was a kid, I'd go to my uncle's now and again, and I want you to tell me about how you do what you're doing there. But and I was only a youngster. I was only about, you know, 8 or 9 or something, and a few blokes, you know, might be 10, they'd come to my uncle's property and they'd go out pig hunting, and they seemed to all walk through the bush and just hunt them out. And as they walked through, the pigs would go before them, and then they'd, you know, collect a few pigs and whatever. And that was a while ago. But the pig numbers seem to have just been, and they're ruining everything. They ruin the agriculture, and they ruin the native. And there's no place for little nesting grass birds and all that sort of stuff. They're horrible things. But we seem to have let it go, Ned, for years and years and years. And then you get a good season or two in a row, and it's almost out of control. I mean, you know, when did you say 30,000 pigs or 5,000 pigs? Sorry,
about 5,000, a bit more than 5,000.
Dropping the bucket.
But it's as good as a chopper shoot. And of course, we've done a lot of research on this sort of thing, and it costs every pig hunter, according to the research, $60.67 to get one pig. And that's tyres, fuel, all the ancillary costs that go with it, what we call recreational hunters in New South Wales are killing about 1.67 million pigs a year, and pouring that money back into these regional economies. Like, it's the pig numbers are out of control. I've been catching pigs for 50 years, which kind of gives you my vintage, but I've never seen anything like it. I've seen localised plagues, but there are just pigs everywhere at the moment, and in big numbers, you know?
I was on the road once in Queensland, and we were tootling along, and we were behind this ute, and on the back of the ute hanging there was about three or four dead pigs. And I stopped the blokes and I talked to them, and they said, we shot these pigs, and I think they take them to some sort of slaughterhouse or whatever. They were dead already, but and they were exported to Germany or something because a lot of, you know, they love wild boar and stuff like that. Why can't we make some money out of things like this? Now, I know it'd be a big thing, but I'm sure there'd be lots of people, and there's a huge population in the world. We should be able to get rid of them.
Absolutely. That was called the box trade. So the box was a chiller that they'd all be taken to, and they'd have to be inspected. Then they were sent to, processing works in Brisbane and places like this, cut up, inspected, sent overseas. But of course, a lot of that was built on the back of the Chernobyl disaster, so that the Europeans couldn't access non-irradiated pigs unless they bought them from us. But every 10 years or so, they would be doing sampling, and eventually the radiation levels got down enough to make them usable in Europe. So the market effectively collapsed here. So if we had a market, even if it was for blood and bone fertilizer, the whole pig hunting community wants that market again, because it's an activity they're going to be involved in. It's a passion for a lot of people, me included, and I can't explain why. It's just a thing, you know. Some people like to
collect stamps.
whatever. Some people collect pigs. So,
Ned, just tell me this: how do you, as I said, we walked little group has walked through the bush. How do you go about the Ningen big boar bonanza? How do you round up the pigs? What happens?
Well, some people shoot. Lots and lots of people use dogs to locate the pigs, and the dogs might either bail up the pig, which is use body language and barking to keep it in one spot, and the pig might be shot. Or they'll use a harder dog that'll find the pig and grab it, and then the usually young men, the bell curve's about 18 to 32, and you'll understand why, they'll grab the pig and kill it while they've got hold of it. So it's a very hands-on sort of activity.
Well, and dangerous.
And we're governed by all sorts of rules, about humane dispatch and things like that. And but it is... it's a physical activity, and it's an incredibly popular activity, particularly in remote areas. But the thing that always strikes me, and all the money that gets raised, people have to pay to enter, and there's sponsorships and auctions and things like that. It all goes into local communities, and it might be a sick kitty or someone whose house burnt down or whatever, and they'll just... they'll just rally around, have these competitions, raise money and put it into, the flying doctor, all sorts of things, because they're all over Australia, particularly on the eastern seaboard. I've never been to one of these pig comps and seen any drama, There's lots and lots and lots of very young and fit sort of people there, and I've never seen a cross word because they're just in such a good mood.
I wish I'd have been there, mate. The Ningen
big boar bonanza. I'll get you an invite.
I'll watch from a distance, Neddy.
Yeah, brace yourself.
All right. Good on you, Ned. Thanks, mate.
Good on you, mate. Thank you very much.
Bye. G'day, this is Macca.
Hello, it's Frank here from down near Boggabri, and we're at Bladder going for a drive to Moree for a junior rugby carnival.
Frank, you're up early and getting into it, mate. So you play rugby, this is rugby union?
Yes, rugby union. I'm in the car with my little brother and my mum.
Okay.
And the other two kids are at Tamworth with my dad, and they are... Rex is doing a cricket academy. He's the oldest one out of the four of us. And Mary, she's going down to pick up a horse with Dad.
This family
behaving well.
Yes, Frank. This family's a sporting family. What's the name of your brother doing the cricket? Rex, is it?
Yep, Rex. Rex is the oldest.
Well, send him
Frank,
up to Darwin. Soon as you talk to him, send him up to Darwin straight away. They need him up there, mate. The cricket's on up there and there. They're struggling.
Yeah.
So, Frank, who do you play for?
We play for the Gunnedah Red Devils.
The Red Devils.
Yeah.
Sounds exciting. Mm-hmm. And is your jumper red? Is it a red jumper? Or?
Yeah, we've got it right now. Wearing it. Yeah, and the seasons down here, it's pretty good down at Boggabri. We've got the crop in and all of the cattle there going well down in the feedlot.
I love it. Frank, let me tell you this. When I used to play baseball, and I played baseball because I loved the uniform, because we had this really great uniform. I played for the Dodgers, and it was green and it had yellow stripes on it. So I used to get up in the morning and put it on, and then I'd go in the train and wearing my Dodgers uniform, because it's a bit like blokes who ride bikes and stuff, and they wear their Lycra and stuff like that. The uniform's the whole deal, I reckon, Frank. It's nothing, you could play in a whole plain, thing, but the uniform in football or whatever, it's just part of, you put it on and you're a different person, Frank, I reckon. I don't know how you feel.
Yeah, we slept in ours last night.
Is that
get up early, and also it's pretty comfy.
Oh, Frank. Yeah, the crops in. Have you had a bit of rain up there in Narrabri?
Yeah, somewhere around there. Yeah, we got a bit at the start of winter. Yeah, the crops, they're just sprouting up now. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, look, you keep. What position do you play, Frank?
I play hooker and prop. I'm a front rower.
Oh, you're a front rower. Okay. So you don't have a lot of pace, or you do, but.
Oh, I do. I'm a bit of an all rounder. Yeah.
Well, that's what we need, and maybe you'll end up as a wallaby, Frank. Who knows?
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe. Well, it's something to aim for, mate. And they've got a good jumper too, so I don't know if they sleep in there, but some of them do. Some of them should. So where are you playing today?
We're playing at Moree.
At Moree.
We're at Bladden now. We just have a little bit of a drive to go.
Yeah, are they good side?
Yeah. We're not playing. We play three games, and we're playing Moree, Inverell, and Tamworth. So it's a bit all around. We play people from the northwest region. Yeah.
Well, I'll see you in Narrabri sometime, and I'll come up. When's harvest? That's about Melbourne Cup Day around there, is it?
Yeah, about October.
October, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Frankie. Good luck today. And
you too.
Say good day to Mum and Dad and all the kids. And as I said, tell Rex to get up there to Darwin. They need him up there, mate.
Yep.
Okay. See ya.
All right. Good boy. Have a great day.
Thanks, Frankie. Bye. This is the All Over News, and it's spectacular. You've probably seen it on the news. The news loves pictures. It was described as spectacular, total solar eclipse swept across Europe from Greenland through to Spain. It says here sky watchers experience the event all over the place, but they're not really sky watchers. They are umbrophiles. And they would have headed to Europe because they haven't had one for 27 years. And I thought, my mate Izzy Perko, he'll be there. He's from Gundagai, but I'm for sure he'll be in Europe and following the solar eclipse, because the umbrophiles love solar eclipses, partial solar eclipses, eclipses of the moon. They just love them. They travel the world. But sadly, Izzy is not in Europe. He's in Brisbane. Good morning, Izzy.
G'day, Macca.
I thought you'd be in Europe.
Everybody thought I was going to be in Europe. Macca, I only went 2 years ago and I saw one in Texas, a total solar eclipse. Mm. And just after that, I went to Spain, in fact. And it was too hot then, and it was way too hot this time. So I knew it would be way, way too hot. More importantly, here in Australia, particularly us Sydney-siders, ex-Sydney-siders in my case, we're going to have a big one in July 2028, so less than 2 years away. Take note, everyone, Saturday, the 22nd of July 2028, big total solar eclipse will go all the way from the Kimberley through the central part of the Northern Territory and then through Thargaminda in Western Queensland and then down through Dubbo and then down to Sydney and finishing in the land of the Long White Cloud in South Island, New Zealand. Mm. And it'll be on a Saturday afternoon. Hopefully it'll be nice and sunny.
And it won't be like the World Cup in terms of people, but there'll be lots of people because they travel all around the world, don't they,
all around the world,
wherever it is at the time.
The thing is, of course, it will be winter, particularly in Sydney and southern New Zealand. So my tip is to go Central Australia. Tennant Creek or to Kalu. Kalu is probably where I'll go. It used to be called Devil's Marbles. Mm. It will be absolutely magical. Remember, the actual total solar eclipse is just a narrow band of about 50 kilometres north to south. So in Sydney, if you're in Sydney, you'll be lucky enough to experience it from Lake Macquarie, south right through the CBD of Sydney. The totality line is actually right through the CBD of Sydney and down to as far south as Bowral. If you're in Mossvale, you won't get totality, but if you're in Bowral, you will. So you've got to try and be just within a line between Lake Macquarie and Bowral on that day, 22nd of July.
Now, umbrophiles get different things, I suppose, out of eclipses, depending what do you like about it and what do others say? I suppose it makes you feel small in this huge world, I suppose. I don't know. What is it?
It does. Once you've experienced one, and I've seen, I think, seven now, from Turkey to Dallas, went to the one in Sedona a few years ago. A total solar eclipse is quite different from a partial eclipse, and it's nothing, you know, a lunar eclipse is nothing, really. It's just it's a total solar eclipse.
Poor man's eclipse,
experience.
Yeah,
I mean, it seems like every second month we get a lunar eclipse, and I think, if you haven't experienced a total solar eclipse, you don't know what an eclipse really is. It's really amazing. Everybody will be saying it's such a pity that Bonnie Tyler's passed away, because, of course, that's the only song that comes that they play during the eclipse.
And there'll be lots of people.
There'll be so many of us umbrophiles. We all know exactly when these eclipses are happening. We're very lucky in Australia in that we've actually got four solar eclipses coming. So if you happen to miss the one in 2028, and you can't miss it, really. The news is going to be so big for, you know, a month or two. Start collecting your eclipse glasses now, because people do run out. So if you've got any eclipse glasses, hold on to them. So we've got another one in November 2030 that goes through South Australia and southwestern Queensland and parts of New South Wales, and then another one in 2037, another one in 2038, and they're all total solar eclipses. So we're very, very fortunate. But the one in Sydney in less than 24 months, in July 2028, Sydney won't have another total solar eclipse for another 800 years. So
be there or be square, eh?
Be there or be square. We're just at hope that, you know, being winter, that it's not going to be too cloudy. So that's the thing.
Izzy, nice to talk to you, mate.
Talk to you again in July 2028.
If not before. Thanks, Izzy.
Okay. Thanks, Macca. Bye-bye.
This is the All Over News.
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. Tomorrow I'll miss you.
That's
It's
Normie Rowe singing, which is really the theme song for Johnny Young, wasn't it, Normie Murray? Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, mate. It was probably, as Bob Hope used to call it, my signature tune. He used to say his song was his signature tune, and that was certainly John's and the Young Talent Team's.
I know you had a lot to do with him, because you used to tell me from time to time you're having lunch with him or doing a concert with him. He was a pop star, and then he was a music mentor with Young Talent Time and things like that. What did he do, say, in the last 20 or 30 years when we didn't hear a lot about Johnny Young?
Well, he went over to WA to live. He was involved in a few different projects. We did one based around the 2015 100th anniversary of the Gallipoli. Unfortunately, didn't quite make it to television, but it was a very good program that was finished. And he was doing a few things. But, you know, one of the things that was really outstanding of John, one of his dear friends, Brendan Clark, developed dementia. And John would pick him up two or three days a week and take him around shopping centres and watch him. And Brendan would walk around, but John kept an eye on him and then took him back to the car and then back to his accommodation. And he did that, and at the same time he was putting his observations of this journey into a book with Lee Tate, who was a journalist from WA, and wrote a book on his mate living his last years with dementia. So it's something that I don't think anybody really knows much about, but I was so impressed and inspired by what John was doing at that time.
And you spent a lot of time with him, because I remember you mentioned you're with him, or you did a concert or two with him here and there, didn't you?
Yes, I did, yeah. Anytime I was in WA, we'd always try and organise it around at least one concert together, and quite a few. The people over there loved the two of us on stage together. So,
of course.
The very last show that he did in the Eastern States, I think, was with me. It was a private function in Melbourne. And he said, look, I'm not walking too good at the moment, so I might need my walking stick, and I might need a chair to sit on. And I got both of those ready for him, and he didn't use either. The audience just loved him. I mean, he had so many songs associated with him, not only the songs that he had, like Step Back and Carolyn, you know, Close Your Eyes, that one, but he also wrote so many songs for other people, and he would sing those, like I Thank You for our world champion boxer Lionel Rose.
Yeah.
And Smiley for...
And The Real Thing, wasn't it?
Ronnie Burns. And The Real Thing for Russell Morris. And he even wrote a song for me called Hello, which was the first recording I did after I came back from Vietnam. He was such a generous sort of person, very intelligent. But one thing that stood out for me, and it was, I only realised it just recently, I think he was the longest running compere of any television show, a national television show in Australia in history. Graham Kennedy didn't do that. Bert Newton didn't do that. Don Lane didn't do it. Ernie Sigley didn't do it.
He was very TV friendly.
Oh, absolutely. But he was a very friendly person. And what you saw on television, that's what John was.
Normie, I'm talking to Normie Rowe. Normie, Tuesday is Vietnam Veterans Day. I know you always do lots and bits and pieces on Vietnam Veterans Day. What are you up to?
I'm going to be at Currumbin, which is, you know, in my neck of the woods these days, the Currumbin RSL. They normally do on Anzac Day, that wonderful dawn service, and any commemorative day, they have something happening there. So we're doing that on Vietnam Veterans Day. And I'm going to sing my new song, which is called We Did It For Each Other. All right, Macca, lovely to talk to you. Everybody out there, and thank you very much.
If you want to know what Australians are doing, listen to Macca on Sunday.
Hey, Macca, this is Scott, just sitting here in Mount Magnet, enjoying the view on a 20-minute break.
Scotty, what are you carrying?
Iron ore in a quad road train.
Four dogs and 30 tonnes, as the song goes. Yeah. Anyway.
I wish it was 30 tonne. I might be able to get going a bit quicker. Come up from Geraldton this morning into Kew. We swap trucks there and then go back into Geraldton and tip off at the port with iron ore and then go home. I think there's a 30-year contract here or somebody thing. I can't remember how many tonne it is, but there's a lot of iron ore to dig up. I only started here on the January. I've been travelling around Australia for 3 years in the caravan with my wife, doing bits and pieces, working, you know, probably 6 months of the year.
Are you cool over there in Mount Magnet this morning?
The gauge on the dash is saying 4 degrees outside.
That's fresh, isn't it? Well, it is winter, isn't it? It is winter, and even in the west, you know, and once you get away from the coast.
14 degrees when I left Geraldton at 1 o'clock this morning. And my little bubble till I get to Kew, then we just put the truck on one side of the road, walk across, get into a loaded one and bring that back.
Hi there, Macca. This is Sandra. We've just been up at Diggers and Dealers, as we do every year in Kalgoorlie, for the big mining conference. We're always doing gold, but at the moment we're off to Paraburdoo, which is up in the Pilbara this afternoon. Rio Tinto have asked us up there, and I haven't been back. The last time was 1969 I was up there, so it's going to be fascinating because it was tiny. Now it's enormous. So it'll be very interesting to see the changes.
Is an anniversary on up there?
Yes, it's 60 years exactly since they had the first commercial shipment of iron ore from Hammersley, as it was then, Rio Tinto now. And so they're celebrating their 60 years, and they made a video for that celebration and asked me to be involved in it. So I've done that, but they're also going up to take some more photos, more footage. Amazed at the change over all those years. So it's going to be fun.
Sandra, you're a geologist, aren't you?
Originally, yes, banker and a few other things on the side as well, yeah.
Hammersley Iron, that's a great Australian name of the past, isn't it?
It certainly is. And my goodness, when you consider when it first started off up in the Pilbara, along with BHP and a couple of other companies that had mines, they were tiny. Yeah. Now they're ginormous. There's a few smaller mines dotted around that part of the world, but, of course, the big ones are up at Tom Price and BHP's Newman. And Fortescue, of course. They're the ginormous ones. There are a lot smaller ones dotted around here and there. It was fascinating because when I was up there, it was only 6 months after they started mining. They'd only taken off about one layer, if you like. And I've got photos of it then. And I can't wait to see what it looks like now. It must be a giant hole, whereas my photo shows it as a mountain. So that's going to be interesting.
Well, yeah. Nice to talk to you, Sandra.
But I noticed you just had somebody on from Broken Hill, and I was talking on the ABC last week about Broken Hill because at one of the operations up there, they managed to penetrate a very difficult part of the ground, and they think they're onto a new ore body.
Oh, really?
So they're pretty happy about that. Yeah, there's more to happen. It doesn't. It's not quick, these things, but they're doing well.
G'day, this is Macca.
Macca, hi, it's Merrin here.
Hello, Merrin.
I'm calling from Lacola, which is a tiny little town in Gippsland at the base of the highland, and it's completely off the grid.
Well, tell me more.
It's actually owned by the Lions Clubs of Victoria and Southern New South Wales.
Mm.
And all that is here is a kids' camp, a store, some fuel, and a little caravan park. And the phone, because I'm calling on the public phone.
Oh, and the public phone. It sounds a bit like a public phone, but it's clear, clear as a bell.
Yeah, great. Yeah, reception's good if you've got Telstra, but if you've got Optus, no chance.
Well, you could always get Elon.
Yes, yes, we do have Starlink for internet up here. I'm helping run the camp at the moment, and we've got a couple of people in this weekend. It's a great place for people to come up, hunters, fishers. We get a lot of four-wheel drive people come through. Fridays and Saturday nights are like peak hour up here, about 10:30. The amount of traffic's unbelievable.
Really?
Yeah, because people leave Melbourne after work and they come up and they either stay in Lacola or head a little further up into the parks. And it's seriously, unless you've seen it or been here for it, you wouldn't believe it would get that busy.
Well, I wouldn't, but I've not heard about it before.
No, so Lacola, we run, we've got solar and batteries and a generator, and the generator's... We have to get a new one shortly because it's very old and starting to cost a lot of money because diesel's very expensive these days. But it's such a beautiful place. The sun's out today. It's if it's like yesterday, I'll have my I'll just be in a t-shirt in about 2 hours.
Well, Merrin, you've got your work cut out for you.
Yes, yes. It's a beautiful spot to come and visit. It's just up from Traralgon or Moe. And about 3 hours out of Melbourne, and it's so peaceful. The amount of birds up here, and it is crazy. Sometimes you wake up in the morning because the cockatoos are just going bananas, and that's all you can hear.
Cockatoos are going bananas, right? Yeah.
Oh, but it's a lovely little spot. And Mel, who's one of our staff members, is running the store and the caravan park, which closed briefly at the beginning of the year, but I just wanted to let people know that Lacola's open. So if you want to come for a drive or a visit, it's a beautiful place to come.
All right, Merrin, good on you. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks very much, Macca.
We found this lovely house.
Yeah, that's the story. It's why I live for a lifetime.
We bought a beachside unit.
We're travelling right
and
around.
And values dropped by $5.
It's a home among the gum trees, and if you've got the time, I'll tell you why I live where I live.
Exactly.
I'll tell you why I live where I live.
Well, Jonathan's not really going to tell us why he lives where he lives, but he sort of does. I used to be a school teacher, says Jonathan Kendall. Worked in Sydney for 6 years before going to London in 87. I stayed there for almost 27 years, taught up to A-level and was head of department in three schools in England. When I came home with references, record of service in training, etc., the New South Wales Education Department rep said, "We don't recognise your work in the UK. As far as we're concerned, you have to been out of service for 27 years and no longer qualified." Wouldn't say that now. There's teacher shortage, isn't there? I replied, "You know what? I know how to knit scarves. I'm going to give that a shot." There began 8 and a half of the happiest years of my life, sitting on the street, knitting scarves from pure Australian wool, using an ancient Egyptian style of frame, producing a double-sided twisted rib. That's what I thought it got from my coughing fit last week, a twisted rib. Anyway, I'd spend the week in town, sitting in an empty doorway or somewhere, not blocking any advertising or access, starting on a Monday morning and working through to Saturday night. On Sunday morning, I'd say my thank you and move on to the next town. I didn't sleep on the street. I had a car and was warm and dry. As a result of talking to people, I realised that the bush poetry wasn't being forgotten. It had been, and I thought that wrong. So I learnt a few of Banjo's, Henry's, a bit of war poetry by Trooper Bluegum, and some others, and was happy to recite them for free, just to keep them alive. In my travels, I got to Cooma the week before steampunk. Inimitable. We talked about that, didn't we, steampunk? I had a bit of cash, so I decided to have a week off and camped at the pub in Nim. That's Inimitable. Free camping. Talking to the publican Kevin Fahey, I soon realised that we would have been in the same pub at the same time back in 78 when he was the lead guitar with Gravel Rash and my best mate's brother John Huey was lead with Jimmy and the Boys at the Windsor Castle in Paddo. We had a great time reminding each other of times and people's past. We swapped numbers and off I went. When COVID hit, I was stuffed. No one was going to approach a hobo on the street. Kel was also stuffed. Business died, and he had to let his two staff go, and he had to run the pub on his own with arthritis and sciatica. But he thought of me and sent me this text. If you need somewhere to be here. I've been there ever since, helping him out and keeping the place running. It'd be fair to say that this place means something to me, and I also caught the bug. That is the poetry bug. And Jonathan sent me a long poem. I won't read it because it only encourages more poetry. But thank you very much, Jonathan. People's lives are interesting, aren't they? From Julie O'Connell, she says, I'm 54 and have been listening since I was a kid, while Dad was driving us to horse shows all around the countryside each weekend. Your program's still a family tradition. Julie says, I live in Wattle Glen, part of Melbourne's Green Wedge. That band of bushland and open space protecting the outer northeasterly corner of the city from being swallowed up by suburbia entirely. Paddle upstream along the Yarra and you'll see why. Tall manor gums, grazing kangaroos, the chime of bellbirds in the air, and signs saying Womanjeka, the Wurundjeri welcome that reminds us of our heritage. Horses have long been part of life here. In the early days of colonisation, they carried timber, mail and supplies through the hills, including the old Cobb and Co routes that linked isolated settlers to the city. Today, horses are no longer our transport, but they're still our heartbeat. I can ride my ex-racehorse down the hill from home to the general store for an ice cream and onward to our metro train station to greet my son after school. A neighbouring friend does real estate rounds on horseback in our local streets, certainly helps reduce her fuel costs. And our equine industry contributes to the local economy and culture, not only in dollar value, but in spirit. Because what keeps me here are the people. When bushfires tore through beyond the northern end of the Shire last December, horse folk rallied instantly, sharing feed, rebuilding fences, raising funds. Likewise, local riding clubs attract more kids and young adults than most of their counterparts within the state and the country. These numbers don't maintain and grow by accident. Parents value the mental and physical health benefits horses bring to their families, even with the cost of living being so high nowadays. The Kangaroo Ground Pony Club is perhaps the only one of its kind that don't lease but own their club land. Individuals and businesses have made this possible, with ongoing improvements of the facilities that make visitors eager to enjoy what we have to offer. That spirit of coming together to make things happen is what inspired my book project, The Horse Folk of Nillumbik, capturing the stories of the people who make this place what it is, and to pay tribute to folk of the past who contributed to making the Shire so horse mad. Horse riding continues to be one of the most popular recreation activities in the Shire. Julie O'Connell says, I wouldn't live anywhere else. And finally, from our back pages, as I said, we would get 20, 30 while ever I live letters a week. This is just one of them. Came from Wani Asa in the ACT. Isn't that a lovely name? And it was from Marion Baker. And Marion said, I don't live in Cootamundra and I don't live back of Bourke, nor do I live in Old Cancoban, nor anywhere near busy Goulburn. And I don't live in Sydney Town, or even where for choice I'd be, over there in WA, in Rockingham or Safety Bay. But I live in the ACT. The Brindabella Ranges comfort me, and the song of the river on its way to the sea brings precious memories of the Murrumbidgee. Beautiful Canberra is growing up fast, with ever more things to do and to see. Many suburbs carry great names of the past, like Mawson and Farrer, Curtin, O'Malley, Mackellar, Chisholm, to name but a few. Maybe they'll call the next new suburb Border, Now, you can tell how long ago this was written because that's referring to our dear friend Alan Border. To honour this man and the team. Just imagine, Macca, what the locals could do with that theme. Why, all over Border on bright Sunday mornings. The bats and the balls would be out and house out shout the bowlers, all hoping the umpires give out. But the umpires, they like clean bowled better. So all over Border, the run rate is rising, the thirst agonising, the runs are piling as the hundreds are made in the backyard at Mum's. As to why I live where I live, that would take the story of my life. This wondrous country calls from afar, and this much, Macca, I'll say, where your children are, your treasure is, and we're all here in Australia to stay. Marion Baker, in Waniasa, thank you for your program. It's a tapestry into which is woven yesterday and today for tomorrow. Long may it continue. If you'd like to write to Why I Live Where I Live, you know the deal. And that's Why I Live Where I Live for this week. G'day, this is Macca.
Hi, Macca, it's Phil Castle.
Who is it? Phil.
Phil, yeah, I was ringing about Vietnam and the 60th anniversary on Tuesday would be 60 years since the Battle of Long Tan, which is a bit of a special day for any Vietnam veteran. So I'm a military historian, so I've studied it. It was a pretty important time. But all of us are about, they have to be the late 70s, we're older, so not too many of us left these days, probably less than a third of the blokes who served. 60,000 Australians served in Vietnam, of which we lost 523 and about 3,000. Yeah, so special day this coming Tuesday.
A forgotten war, a bit like Korea in some ways.
Oh, Korea was very much a forgotten war. I think Vietnam's a bit more acknowledged. Most of the RSLs still have some members. The branch I'm in, I just did a report on them. I'm a retired journo, print journo, and we've got 24 members of our branch who served in Vietnam in various capacities. It's, you know, very proud to have done so there's no regrets there. Weren't initially very well received by the RSL, which was a shame, but then they turned it around, so that was good. The Welcome Home Parade was the big change when that happened in Sydney.
And when was that? What year was that?
87, I think it was, through the streets of Sydney. I was part of that. It was a very, very memorable occasion. And I think that was the first time that the Vietnam veterans really got properly acknowledged.
Yes, I'll say it was interesting's not the word, interesting time. Any time there's a war on, even when the First World War and conscription and all that, there's always a drama, isn't there? There's always for and against and divisions in society. Look at the divisions in our society now. They've never been any more apparent, really, to me. But it's about war too. It's wars around the world all the time, isn't there now? And you know,
it's pretty sad. Some of the blokes not coping very well. Some of them have taken their own lives, which is pretty sad. But I think the fellows the men and women out of Afghanistan are probably suffering more. But that's another story. Very, very bittersweet things for them.
Yeah.
But look, the guys, the people who were in Vietnam, I'm very proud of what they did. It's very professional. I think we did a good job as much as we could, but, you know, for what? It really didn't turn out very well because the communists took over, so that was I wonder why it all happened.
So that's Tuesday, isn't it? Vietnam Veterans Day, Long Tan Day, really, but now it's called Vietnam Veterans Day.
It is. That's the day we used to celebrate. There was one other battle, which a lot of veterans and myself sort of feel needs to be acknowledged, and that was the Battle of Coral Balmoral.
Yep.
That was more extended. That was a little bit later in 68, and there were almost 30 Australians killed in that. But we just wonder why so many died, which was rather pointless when you look back on it. But sad.
All right, Phil, good on you, mate. Nate, thanks for your call.
Well, thanks for giving us a thumbs up. That'll be good.
It's a pleasure, mate. Bye.
Okay, cheers. Bye.
Wayne's at Eastern Creek. Morning, Wayne.
G'day, Macca. How are you?
Mate, I'm all right. Yep.
Did you recover from sitting in my Brabham that time I brought it into the studio?
No, I did me back in, mate. I did me back in. Isn't it amazing? How did they get into those? I mean, much younger, but Jack was a fairly bulky bloke, wasn't he, Jack Brabham?
Yep, he was pretty solid. Anyway, the purpose of calling was that the Combined Motor Club's Day is on at Eastern Creek at Sydney Motorsport Park today, with every imaginable old and new car you can sea out here, and there's about 2,000 cars booked to come out here, I think, from... That's an old MGTC in front of me making noise.
I couldn't hear it. Anyway, go on.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. And there's VW Beetle Club over there, and Mustangs over there, and so forth. And it's a big day.
What's it called? What's the day called?
Combined Motor Club, CFC Day, which Shannon sponsor, which they have the whole of the circuit taken over by all these car clubs. They get about 10 or 20 spots each, and they all come out and show their cars off and have a good time, and they each get to drive around the circuit.
I would think you get a lot of people at that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's quite a decent public come in. They're welcome from about 10 o'clock. They're going to pay to get in, I think.
And, we're mad about cars. Australians are mad about well, everybody is. People love their cars, don't they?
Yep. And you certainly see that out here today with all these people going with their beautifully restored and kept cars. You know, there's I just saw a Saint car, you know, Volvo P1800 the Saint used to drive in that TV series. And there's a Bentley just went past. And
wow.
All sorts of those Chrysler Valiants and all sorts of stuff. But we've got the racing cars on display from the Historic Racing Association, and there's a whole bunch of those here at the entrance. And unfortunately, they don't let us go out on the circuit because we go too fast.
I wonder what the future will be, Wayne, of cars. You know, I mean, you can still find Model T Fords and cars from the 20s and whatever, but... electric cars seem to be the go, not for me, but they seem to be the go, but they don't seem to have the gravitas of a Mustang or a Lamborghini or one of those early Porsches early Range Rover
viscal, some of those cars that you mentioned. They have the, you know, the power that comes through from the engine. You can feel it and so forth, and you can't feel that in an electric car. They do say that some of the electric cars from China are made by companies that have never built a car before and used to make Mixmasters. So if you want to drive a Mixmaster.
No.
But we'll see what happens over the period of time. But it does prove all these cars are the ones you see on the streets occasionally with what's called club plates. They've got these funny number plates with J at the end of them or H at the end of them.
Mm.
And they're all the ones that get to come out today because this is one of their approved days out on their limited registration.
Yeah.
And there's a Ferrari. Very nice. It's just pulled up next to me. It's a big day out. And there's lots of food and drinks and other stuff out here. And
all right.
Once they start moving, they'll let them all go out to do a couple of laps around the circuit. They have buses that from the Vintage Bus Association, they have scout cars from the Army Museum.
It's all happening at Eastern Creek, Wayne. Good on you, mate.
Sort of stuff. Okay, nice to talk to you again, Macca.
See you, mate. Bye.
Okay, take care. Have a good weekend.
Peter's at Ipswich. What's happening, Pete?
Good morning, Macca. I'm actually at Wakaraka, which is just outside of Ipswich. I just dropped off some luggage for some cyclists who are cycling on the Brisbane Valley Rail Trail. And now I'm on the way to the Homefront Festival, which is this year's Brisbane celebration of VP Day, which was yesterday, Victory in the Pacific. And it's being hosted at the heritage site of the former Camp Columbia, which is now Wilson House. And it's going to be a really fantastic day with some of the speakers from the Camp Columbia Heritage Association doing addresses on what is a really incredible piece of Brisbane's history when it was the headquarters of General MacArthur. And I don't know if you knew or not, there's over 240 pure World War II memorials in Brisbane, as many in Brisbane as what there is in Hawaii, believe it or not.
I wonder why that is.
Well, as I said, it was the headquarters of General MacArthur.
Mm.
There was the submarine base in the Brisbane River. There was the South Brisbane Dry Dock, which was repairing dozens and dozens of war-damaged ships The Cane Cross Dock was built just towards the end of World War II. There was Eagle Farm, there was Archerfield. It was just a hub of the American headquarters of the Southwest Pacific as we fought the Japanese.
All right. So that'll be a big day, Pete.
It will be incredible. A fellow called Camp Buddle, Paul Buddle, I should say, is doing some really interesting discussions because the only time in Australia's history where there was a government in exile was based in Brisbane, which was the Dutch East Indies government from Indonesia. And at Camp Columbia, they've done archaeological digs. They found some incredible memorabilia from the government in exile and also the American occupation of that particular site. And it's now part Camp Wilson House. It's part a forestry area called Poo Corner because there was a sewage works there. And that's where they've actually done a lot of this archaeological digs because it was a rubbish dump, sewage works, and, you know, people's occupation, everything gets thrown out in the tip, everything gets shoved down the toilet. So it's a really productive place to do some archaeological digs. And they found a dagger, believe it or not, from the West Indians government in exile on the site. So it's just amazing what comes out of some of these heritage sites in Brisbane.
Speaking of MacArthur, there's a hotel in Sydney called the Grace Hotel, which is a lovely, lovely, I don't know if it's Art Deco or whatever, but MacArthur stayed there, I suppose, before he went to Brisbane, but he stayed there for a good while at the Grace Hotel, and there's little plaques and memorials there about that and about that time in our Australian history. So there you go.
You know, one of the most interesting places to visit in Brisbane is the MacArthur Museum, and that was his headquarters for 3 or 4 years. And VP Day, even though MacArthur was based outside of Brisbane at the time, his main headquarters and family was still based in Brisbane. And he had flown into Brisbane and was actually in Brisbane when when the surrender was announced. Incredible as that may sound.
All very interesting. Good on you, Pete.
Thank you, Macca.
That's what's it called? Homefront?
Homefront celebration at the Wilson Farmstay Heritage Site just at Wacol.
That's today.
In about another hour's time.
All right, mate. Good on you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye. Two and Lottie's on the line. Morning, Lottie.
Morning, Macca.
Where are you, Lottie?
I'm in Bathurst.
And you wanted to tell me something, or tell me?
Yeah, I wrote a poem to say to you.
Well, you better hurry up because we've got 3 minutes. Away you go. What's the poem called?
Down the Back Roads.
Okay, go for it.
The time has come to pack our junk and head down the back road. Across the rail truck, through an old dirt road. Racing the mighty cattle truck. Old red Land Cruiser rattling and bumping on the cracks. Singing high note country songs. Whistling along, groaning as Dad sings a solo. Finally arriving quickly as we dodge the highway. By Lottie.
Well, that's lovely. You do a bit of this. You like to write some poetry, Lottie?
Yeah.
There you go. And you live, whereabouts do you live? In Bathurst?
Yeah. Well, like just out of Bathurst.
And you got a farm there?
We have 12 acres.
So that's enough. That's enough. That's good to go for a walk, and you've got your own animals and horses and dogs and stuff?
I wish I did, though. We have a dog, though.
Well, Lottie, you're 10 years old?
Yes.
And what school do you go to?
Perthville Public.
Perthville school. Public. There you go. All right. Well, it's a lovely little poem, and keep up the good work. I'll see you sometime in or out of Bathurst or at Perthville. I'll come to your school one day, eh? How's that sound?
Good.
All right. Good on you. Lovely to talk to you.
Uh-huh. Bye.
Bye. On the line, I have our roving correspondent, Peter Joseph, who was in Washington years ago when the war brides met in Washington. Dennis Richardson was over there at that time. Dennis was the, I think, ambassador. Was he the ambassador? Whatever. But Peter gets around. Last week he rang us, and I think he was going to the. He was going to the rugby, wasn't he, last week? And he's on the line. I don't know where he is. Peter Joseph, good morning.
Yeah, good day, Macca. How are you going?
Yeah, I'm good, mate.
It's a double header. Last week was Melbourne at the for Spuds game at Marvel Stadium. 40,000 people turned up. Thanks for the shout out. Yeah. The theme was Light in the Darkness. And they turned the lights out of the stadium for 2.5 minutes, and we turned our lights on our torches. It was very emotional, there were the players, St Kilda and Carlton were out in the middle. It was just brilliant.
And what was that like to be there, mate? It must have been, yes, just hairs on the back of your neck, I suppose.
Absolutely next level, and... It's a great stadium, and this week, double header, no rest for the wicked backer. I'm in Townsville with some family and also a Japanese Australian friend of mine, Shu Sugasaki, is with me now, and he had the Sapporo restaurant in Crow's Nest for years. That's where we got to know.
Yeah.
Big supporter of the Wallabies. The Wallabies played Japan here. Had a big win.
That's right. They played yesterday. They played last week, didn't they? And they won by a couple of points. And now they've won.
Yeah, and this week they put 50 points on Japan. And Shu's a big supporter of the Wallabies. But he was asked by the Australian Rugby Union if he'd sing the Japanese national anthem.
Wow.
Has got a rich history dating back to, I think he said, 900 AD. It's the oldest anthem in the world.
Right.
And he's a musician like you, a singer like you. I just thought you'd love to say hello to Shu.
I would, Pete. You get around. Yeah, is he there now with you, is he?
Is he here right now?
Hi, Maka.
Hi, Shu. How are you going?
Hi. Good, thank you.
I'm a big fan.
And you're a Wallaby supporter, despite the fact that your antecedents were playing there yesterday.
Yes, when I was 20, I came to Australia to study at the university. And most importantly, I wanted to play rugby. And then I played for the East Tigers in Brisbane. That's where I learned many aspects of Australian culture.
Good and bad, I suppose.
Or better or bad, yes.
Yeah, go on.
And since then, I am a strong Wallaby supporter. But also, I have a passion to sing. And this is one of my dreams, to sing Advance Australia for the Wallabies one day.
Mm.
But this time, I was given the honour to sing the Japanese national anthem yesterday.
Oh, wow. That'd be, well... And there's a big crowd there, obviously.
Yes, 20,000.
Yeah.
Wow.
In the Queensland Country Bank Stadium in this beautiful regional city of Townsville. Absolutely buzzing.
I'll bet. Shu, you said you came here when you were 20, is that right? Well, 20 years, yeah, when you were 20.
Yes,
and what
only
was
10 years ago.
And what was that? What was the reason for that?
So I had to finish my university degree, which I went through halfway in Japan. Mm. But I really wanted to play rugby in Australia.
Wow! tell me about rugby in Japan. I know they play it, but is it how popular? I mean, baseball's the big thing in Japan, isn't it? Yes. Everyone loves it, and you've got that.
Maybe baseball, soccer. And the still sumo is very strong too.
Mm.
And then maybe rugby comes next.
It seems to be, but it seems to be growing, rugby. But then again, when you look around the world, sport and football, wherever you look, it's that football, wherever you are, and then everything else, you know, a couple of miles behind. You know, football's taken over the world, I think. So it just seems to me that, you know, when you're hiring coaches like Eddie Jones to coach in Japan, must mean there's a bit of dough around. And football, again, it's really all about money, isn't it, wherever you look for football?
Yes. But maybe I think rugby is suitable for Japanese sort of spirit. They sort of put your body on the line and then help others and things. And now the junior rugby's developed all over Japan. And then yesterday, number 10, Japanese player, he's been playing rugby since 3 years old. Many Japanese rugby players, they started early, very early. So physically, they still, of course, smaller compared to other nations, but their speed and the rugby brain has been developed quite a lot.
Well, it's like their soccer. They're all nippy and very fast. But and I was thinking about this, you know, the other day, as you do when you've got nothing to do and you're thinking about things. And I thought, why don't they get some of those sumo wrestlers in the front row? That's the end of the story.
I thought about it exactly what you're thinking the other day. They are sumo wrestlers, are very athletic. Some of them are very fast in 50 meters. So. It may work if they're once they're retired.
But they're huge, mate. They're huge. That's the deal. When you look at the way they scrum, I can just see you had a few sumos up the front there, and Peter. Yeah. I can hear Peter laughing in the background. And it's a no-brainer. I think it would just maybe. Has the coach thought about that? Have any of the coaches thought
about
it?
I'm not sure. I don't know if Eddie's thinking about this, but maybe as an impact player. Can be very useful.
But the other thing is that sumo wrestlers would get paid a lot of money. Is that right? Am I right? Or am I...
Not really, unless you become a very top compared to other sports. Yeah. It's a very unique sport. It's more still somehow feudalistic society. Yeah. So they don't. The lower division never get paid.
Oh, really?
Mm.
So they do it for love, like people used to do with football, eh, Pete?
Yeah, that's it.
Now, Shu, I'm talking to Peter Joseph in Townsville and his mate Shu Sugisaki. Shu, you wouldn't sing the Japanese national anthem for us, would you? Would you? Some of it or all?
Some of them.
A little bit.
Why? Is it long? Is it long?
No. Well, whole thing is about 1 minute.
Yeah. Well, that'll do. I'm up for it if you are. We all are.
Oh.
There you go.
See how you go. See how you go, and then you can...
Maybe to the middle.
Yeah. All right, to the middle. Okay. Okay.
Imi ga yo wa chi yo ni ya chi yo ni. It goes like this.
Oh, mate, you can't leave us hanging, Shuey. That's just wonderful. Bravo. And you did this in the, and I suppose it echoed and travelled around the whole stadium. It was, again, another spine-tingling moment yesterday.
It really was. The part of the audience, Marco, I can say that it was utterly inspiring. Very emotional, quite operatic. Just brought a tear to the eye.
Can I explain about this?
Yes, yeah. Go for it.
Maka, when I was a child, I used to wonder why Japanese national anthem is not uplifting ones, you know, like other nations. And as I got older, I started to appreciate its quiet beauty. And Japanese national anthem is a very unique national anthem. They took 11 years to establish this national anthem during the modernization of Japan about 150 years ago. And the melody is based on traditional scale, and the lyrics comes from the collection of poetry compiled in 905 AD. So that makes the Japanese national anthem lyrics the oldest in the world.
Wow, that's it's a wonderful thing. See, and we've all learnt, people listening around Australia this morning have all learnt a whole lot, Shuey. And I've not known about that, but yes, there's more to the, as you said, there's more to something like the anthem. See, some anthems are just, you know, trotted out, but there's obviously more than that to meet the eye. Just hold on for a minute, because up in Darwin, there's a cricket match on this morning, and our Darwin listeners have to leave us now. And we'll see you next week, Darwin. And Shuey, look, thank you for that. I could listen to that all day. And everybody here is nodding. They're just beside it. You better come in one morning. What else do you sing, Shuey? You said you like singing. Was it, Peter? You should come in. Do you sing other things, good. Shuey?
Well, I've tried to sing my kind jazz guitarist friends. He's my mentor, and then he let me sing with his bands 2-3 times a month at the pub in Sydney.
He gets more nervous about that than seeing the stadium.
Yes.
Well, we'll have to come and see you. We'll have to come and see you.
We'll bring him in.
Yeah, all right. That'd be great. Good on you, Pete. Thanks for
good on you, mate. Thanks again for the big support for Black Dog Institute last week.
You're the one, mate. You're the one. And Shu, lovely to meet you. And we'll catch up sometime. And thank you.
Thank you. Same to you. Thank you. See you, mate.
Bye. My guest this morning is Janice Kirsch, who has been a restaurateur, a chef,
a caterer,
you name it. She's been there and done that.
Yeah.
But wasn't it great, Janice? Did you enjoy hearing
that young kid Frank?
Yeah,
no, he was beautiful.
Yeah, and what about Shu Sugisaki?
Oh no, that was wonderful.
I've never heard the Japanese anthem
to be
before.
That old.
Yeah.
Since 900 AD.
Yes,
that's extraordinary.
Yeah,
isn't it?
It is. It's a bit like it's almost Homerian.
Yes.
Well, if you know what I mean.
Yes, I do. And and the wallabies, about a half a dozen wallabies turned up at my nephew Quentin's Elite Rodeo on Thursday.
And spent the day on today, isn't it?
I don't know.
That's on today, isn't it? The Elite Rodeo in
No, it's
in
finished. Finished last night. Friday, Saturday.
I thought it was on today too.
So you're going to come next year, I'll go up there. Okay, it's a date. You can sing, because they have a big concert after, like at about 11 o'clock at night. The concert starts, goes till about 3 in the morning.
I thought you were going to say, and you can ride.
No, you can sing.
Now, Janice has brought in a cake, because we've done little bits and pieces over the years.
Yes.
We've celebrated the Harbour Bridge, and we celebrated the ABC's, 80th, and we're
whatever.
At Pyrmont Bridge.
Pyrmont Bridge, definitely.
Pyrmont Bridge and things around the place. And Janice and Raymond made a cake for each time.
That's right, yes.
I remember the Harbour Ridge one, which was this lovely chocolate cake with this chocolate goldy bridge on it. And she's turned up. She rings up last week, and I don't know why. She's made a cake.
He did, Raymond.
Raymond
the chef.
Made. And what sort of cake is that?
It's a traditional Christmas cake, because it was Christmas in July last week.
That's right.
The 25th.
Right. So Raymond's made that, and he's a little champion, Raymond.
Oh, he's amazing.
Amazing person.
Yeah.
And you've been involved in catering and food forever?
Yeah, since I was 20.
And it's still the flavour of the month and getting bigger and bigger, isn't it?
Particularly, I mean, as you know, we pioneered the use of Indigenous ingredients.
I know.
Because in the 60s, we were at Balgo Mission. Our brother John, who you know, he was there establishing a 5.5 million acre horse and cattle breeding station with the Kagatu people. And Raymond and I went and visited him, and that's where we first tasted and enjoyed Indigenous ingredients.
like witchetty grubs and
like yes.
I've got a lovely little midgum bush at home.
Yes,
And it's quite prolific and and they taste they're unique.
They are.
It's not a strong flavour, but you can have them with ice cream. And I'm sure you had Edna's Table for didn't you? And
then
you
had 25 years.
And then you had the other place which was you were selling just in you were making indigenous meals and stuff, weren't you there? Was that in near the town hall there or something?
Yes, in Clarence Street. Yeah. That was the last one.
But that must have been difficult in its way because hard to get supplies of all.
Yes, it was exactly.
And like kwandongs and things like that?
Oh, it was hard, but the biggest problem was it was ridiculously expensive. So even then, we would have kwandongs, they'd be $85 a kilo. So everything was $60 a kilo upwards.
Mm.
And that's what I think scared some of our leading chefs said to me, Janice, we're too busy paying our mortgage. You'll never pay your mortgage because I said, oh, I haven't got a house anyway because it's too expensive.
Yeah.
So, you know, but we thought it was a great thing for reconciliation.
Mm.
And we thought that the whole problem in Australia is it's a desert. These foods grow here in the desert.
In the desert, exactly.
And that's my point.
And they're
point.
A long way from anywhere. Apart from anything else, they're a long way from anywhere.
Yes.
And they don't grow like kwandongs. You might find a patch of them and some of them are terrible and then you'll find some. And then I know the CSIRO was trying to breed them. They'd find good so-called
good
qualities, and
really?
So they worked on getting quanta, but they're not. It's not like having an apple orchard where there's apples every thousands. It's bits and pieces.
Well,
like,
because no one is really except for we were the first restaurant to ever use finger limes.
All right.
The person who discovered them was a scientist, and she came to see us at Edna's Table, and we started using them, and a big German company got hold of them and started farming them up near the back of the North Coast, you know, around that area because it's so lush.
Yeah.
So, but they're selling very well and they're absolutely unique. I mean, the flavour is so, so strong. Have you had a finger lime?
No, but I've got one planted in a pot, in a big pot.
Good.
And they've got little spikes on them too, haven't they?
But not really the skin. No,
not on the skin. No,
you mean on the plant.
On the plant, But no, I've got one in a pot and it's quite good.
Well, we've got the biggest lemon myrtle tree in our little front yard in Redfern.
Mm.
And it's just amazing. It just grows and grows and grows. And we put it in, and it was about 4 inches high when we put it in the tub.
And you can dry the leaves and make tea with them and all sorts of things. And
absolutely,
I'm talking to Janice Kirsch, and Janice is a long-time friend of the family.
Yes, we are.
And that cake, thank you very much. I love cake, whatever it is.
Yes.
But Janice has bought a program from the opera, and we play some opera from time to time.
Yeah.
This is Opera Australia, and it's called The Drover's Wife.
Right, that's right. It's adaptation of Henry Lawson.
Right, and starring, amongst others, it's written by Leah Purcell, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
She's a director.
And George
Palmer.
George Palmer, who wrote the music.
Right. And,
yes. He's an eminent Sydney judge who writes operas.
Really?
Interesting.
Well, everyone has got to have a side hustle, haven't they,
if you know what I mean?
Something you want to do. And you went to see this when?
Oh, yes. It finished yesterday.
Oh, right.
It was on just last week. So when it comes to Sydney next time, it's going to Melbourne now, and when it comes to Sydney, I'm going to take you and Lee.
All right.
There's two dates I'm giving you. One is that, and the other one is coming up to
Townsville.
Elite Rodeo.
Yeah, right.
Oh, wait there. And the other thing, there were a half a dozen wallabies there, as in the players, on Thursday.
Uh-huh.
So I'm sure they didn't drink.
Now, Janice, so what was it? You went to see that. What was it like?
It's wonderful.
Why?
It's very good.
Hmm?
Well, the music and also the storyline, you know, it's very powerful, very powerful. And it's beautifully done. And it's an introduction between George's music, which is just beautiful, and the indigenous culture that Leah composed certain things, not music, but, you know, the libretto.
Yeah.
And so it really touches on how things were, how they were. But it's beautifully done. And it's Leah's niece, who's a soprano, who's just glorious to look at. And beautiful. Oh, she is. She's just amazing.
Really?
And she sings like an angel. Absolutely. Oh. Yes.
Yeah. Opera's very popular in some ways, isn't it, too? Even it's an ancient craft. Yes. But yes. It's,
I think it's the first time there's been a few words, little words that we swear words that's never been in an opera before.
Oh, really?
The audience just laughs, you know, they love that.
Yeah,
yeah. I bet. We're Australian, you know, we like all that. Honesty.
So, George Palmer's
he's a Sydney judge. Mm, yeah.
But he's done the music, hasn't he?
Oh, yeah, he's a very good composer.
Mm.
And he said to Leah, he went to the Drover's Wife's play, and he said to Leah after the play, I want to do a really good Australian opera. What about if we collaborate
mm.
and we do The Drover's Wife as an opera? And she said, well, I'm just an ordinary black fella. An opera? He said, Leah, you can do it. You're so talented. And she is. So they've been a great team together.
So it's travelling now.
It's going to Melbourne next week or the week after.
And how long's the run? How long do they do?
The runs are short because it only premiered in Brisbane 10 days ago.
I see.
Yeah. So, but they've been booked out for, you know, like they did five in the last week.
What an experience.
Yeah. Oh, it's wonderful. You would have loved it. Mm. Yeah, but you'll go. Don't worry. I'm on the job. Definitely going. Yeah, and guess what the other thing is?
What's the other
we're thing? Doing with...
You're full of surprises. You
no, are. I know. Well, we're doing some work with the Powerhouse Museum. They ask us to contribute because they're doing some big thing for the history of Australian food.
All right.
Yeah, and it's very good because there's an oral part to it. My oral part goes for 42 pages.
Oh, really? And can you tell us something about that?
Well, it does go, they want to know how we got to what we did, and particularly to do with indigenous ingredients.
Mm.
And they said, no, we don't want you to hold back because we want the story of what you really like and how you really feel. And if, you know, your brother swears a couple of times, just leave those words there. We want to get the spirit.
So
it'll be good, I think. Yeah. I think it'll be good.
And and the wattle seed has been a part of cooking, hasn't it?
Of course.
And, yeah.
Of course.
And all that.
Oh, we love it.
And I remember we were going on the gun barrel and we passed a group of indigenous people and they were in a truck and they'd all got off and they were eating the grevillea, which is like the...
Oh, they love that.
Yeah, well, everywhere. We started eating. It's beautiful. So, and the nectar is so...
Well, it's that, but it's also because it's such rich liquid.
Yeah, it is. Yes. It's beautiful. Yes. It's beautiful.
Yes.
Definitely. It's like honey, really, it is.
No, it's fantastic.
And if there's been a drop of rain or early in the morning when there's been some dew, even out in the desert, and it's just delicious.
But particularly out the desert. Yeah. I mean, when we were at Balgo, that's how we were introduced to it by the Kagyu people, and it was extraordinary what they would give me because I was cooking in the stock camp and they'd bring me in things that they were happy with. They couldn't speak English, but they were very happy with what I was doing, being the cook, and, you know, breakfast, smoko, lunch, dinner, with a little pot.
Well, you know, you're a little trendsetter because cooking, like fashion, like everything, like music, and movies, for God's sake. We've just seen The Odyssey. Oh, give me a break. Yeah. But it's all about fads.
Yeah, it is.
And you sort of started that with the native plants and all that sort of stuff, and it's been wonderful. Yeah. Janice, just hang on. I've got to take a call. Janice Kirsch is my guest this morning, chef and restaurateur, caterer.
Mad woman.
Opera lover and friend of the family. And that's where the morning goes, Janice.
Great to see you.
Great to see you too. I saw this Guillaume cooking on TV the other day, and he was cooking tarte aux pommes, which is a little, and he had the little pastry, and he had this apple, and he sliced this apple, but I'd never seen an apple like that. It was like one of these yellow, we get all these big Fujis and things like that, but the French don't seem to, they have much more of those heirloom varieties that they've used for cooking for hundreds of years, and they still do it. So.
But I still love the Granny Smith. Oh, a good Granny Smith, juicy beyond belief.
Janice Kirsch, I love you. Thank you very much for coming.
Okay,
we've enjoyed. I'm going to go and listen to the Japanese national anthem.
Oh,
Shusugisaki, I love it. Baseball, rugby union.
Yes.
I'd like to thank Peter and Antonia and Lee Kelly's shot through. I don't know where she's gone. Thanks for your company this morning. It's been. It's my friend since he doesn't say it's it's unreal, mate. He says it's been real. It's been real, kids.
Legend.
It's been real. Stay tuned on the ABC for the morning show. It's always, it's just interesting beyond belief. There you go. I hope you enjoyed our highlights package. If you want the full Monty, listen in every Sunday morning from 5:30 till 10 and tune into Australia. If you see me on the road, stop and say g'day. Contact me at macatracks@gmail.com. Talk to you Sunday.